Hey cutie, you know what this is. Even though it isn't Monday, it's still time for Get to Know Night. That's somewhat weekly show where you ask me questions and I give you answers to the best of my ability. As always, there are so many questions, so let's just jump right into it, shall we? The first question I have is from Anonymous. They ask, hey Kay, I'm 26 and for years, due to personal circumstance, I haven't dated anyone. The last time I was with someone, I was 21. At my age, do you think it's too late for me to date somebody? No, not at all. Not at all. I don't think it's ever too late for anyone to date anyone. I think whenever you date anyone, there's always a window. There's always a chance. It never closes. It's always open. But yeah, I think it isn't too late. It isn't too late at all. You're going to find somebody. If you're open to meeting someone and you're looking and you're active and you're intentional and you know what you want, then yeah, I think you can meet somebody. I don't think it's ever too late for anyone. I feel like I've gotten so many variations of that question of, is it too late or will I never meet the person, or I've never had a boyfriend and I'm X years old. Is it too late for me? And I think my answer is unilaterally, it's not too late. Everyone's on their own timetable, on their own schedule. There is no, you should be dating X amount of people by this age, or you should have this many boyfriends by this age. I don't think any of that exists. You are going at your own pace, just like life. There's no blueprint, there's no layout, there's no, you should be doing X by X. I think that's crazy. You know, you will move at your own pace. You know, when you're ready for something, then you'll be able and open to receiving it. I feel like there's a lot of pressure, especially internal pressure that gets applied. And I mean, also external, there's both levels of pressure when it comes to partnership. And I think that we need to remove that pressure, because that pressure isn't doing anything helpful. It's only creating, you know, it's only creating bad internal thoughts. It's only creating more anxiety around this thing that shouldn't be producing any anxiety. Like, you will meet someone when you meet somebody. You will find that person when you find that person. And it's not like a race. You're not racing for it. I know, so for some people, you're like, I can't wait to be in this situation. But I would say give it time. Enjoy the place where you are right now. Enjoy the space where you are right now. There's no rush. There really isn't. I remember there was a time when there was a lot of people in my life who had partners, and I did not have a partner at the time. And I was so internalizing that as like, oh, there's something wrong with me. You know, I'm not good enough. Like all these like really horrible things that I was just like turning inward on me. And in retrospect, when I look back, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I didn't have a partner, because I wasn't ready yet to be the partner that I wanted to be. You know, I hadn't matured enough. I wasn't like all the things I'd want to be for someone else. I didn't know myself well enough to give myself to someone else, you know? Because there's a lot of elements to partnership, and I think a lot of it's like internal, like self-growth and development that you need to have. Because when you choose to couple up with someone, you are basically teaching them you. And you have to be the master of you. You have to know yourself so well that you can teach you, you know? It's a really critical part of partnership that I don't think anyone really talks about. But it's really true. I think that space between 21 and 26, you got to learn yourself so much more now. So now when you jump into a partnership, you're going to be so much more equipped to help guide your partner into knowing you, and you'll be way more receptive into understanding a partner, and like that partnership could work way stronger than had you not taken that space and taken that time to develop and grow in between 21 and 26, you know what I mean? So it's not too late. I don't think it's too late. I think we're, as people, we are constantly learning about ourselves and growing to love ourselves more and develop and all that kind of stuff, and that's so important when it comes to partnership. I think it's one of those like cornerstones that just doesn't get talked about. So it isn't too late. And I think it's never too late for anyone, you know? Some of my favorite stories, some of the ones that I think have moved me the most, is when I hear, I've talked to a lot of people who are at the like kind of the tail end of their lives. And I when I talk to them about things like love and loss, and they talk to me about, like, you know, like, oh, I was 65 when I got divorced, and I didn't think I would ever find love again. And then at 67 years old, I met her, and she was, like, the person that I've always been, like, looking for. And, like, we, you know, the only regret I have is we just didn't have enough, we didn't have more time together and all this kind of stuff. And it really is true that you will find people. You'll find people at any point in time. You'll find them in any kind of, like, you'll find them throughout your life. So there's no rush. There's no timetable. I hope that helps, because I know it's something that a lot of people have a lot of anxiety about. I get it. I used to have just so much anxiety about that too. This idea of, like, you should be this, you should be that. But, like, I think the best advice I can give you is don't think about it. You're on your own time. You know, when you meet someone, when you find someone, it's when you find someone, and you will find someone. There is someone out there for you. There's someone out there for everyone. There really is. I truly don't believe this idea that, like, people are on, like, some people think they're unlovable. There's no such thing. Everyone's lovable. Everyone deserves to be loved. Everyone's going to find that love. You know, if you want that love, if you're really interested in it, it'll find you. It really will. It really, really, really will. So, yeah, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for the question. I really appreciate you being vulnerable enough to ask that question. That really means a lot to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's see. Anonymous asks, what is your thoughts on the increased usage of games for TV show and movie source material? I like it because they're doing a good job with it. I remember, like, back in the day when they had, like, the Super Mario movie, not the animated one. The one that I don't think anyone remembers, the live action one, which was abysmal. But yeah, we used to make really bad video game adaptations, like way back when. So this current trend of good video game adaptations has been nice. Fallout comes to mind specifically. Fallout was really good. Last of Us is also quite good. What else? I did not like the Halo TV show. I know some people are going to be upset by me saying that, but yeah, it, as someone who really loves Halo and would, I don't want to say who would really would, if someone wants to tap me to write a Halo script, I would be more than happy to write a Halo script. That would be quite good. But yeah. Yeah, I was really upset by Halo, but yeah, everything else has been pretty good. I've been pretty happy with, what other video game adaptations have there been that's been really good? Actually, yeah, the Super Mario Brother movie has been pretty good. And I mean, like, as like cheesy as those movies are, Sonic is quite enjoyable. Like, it's a fun ride. Well, I'd say it's like high art, no, but is it like a fun movie? It's a fun movie. So yeah, I have no problem with it. I'm excited for it. I like the idea of those IPs getting the love they deserve and getting their chance on the big screen. So yeah, I'm a fan so far. I hope it doesn't get oversaturated like superheroes. That would bum me out. But yeah, I think a good balance of it is not bad. I'm waiting for science fiction to get its resurgence. That'll be the day I'll be super happy when sci-fi gets a resurgence. We'll see if it happens. Maybe the next 5 or 10 years. Fingers crossed. So thank you so much for the question, Anonymous. I really, really, really appreciate it. Let's see. Oh, Nick asks, hey, Knight, what is a personal flaw you've been working on or have recently overcome? Big hug from Melbourne, Australia. Oh, I love Melbourne. Personal flaw. I haven't overcome it, but it's definitely something I am actively working on. It is, like, perfectionism and, like, wrestling with that. I think perfectionism, for me, I equated perfectionism with exceptionalism, you know, like, to do something perfectly would be to do it exceptionally. But I don't think that's true. And I think if anything, it hurts me and hurts the final product of things I do and make. I think it's pretty unhealthy for me to try to be perfect every time. Like, if something isn't perfect, I will throw it away and I will start from scratch. And I will, like, that is, it's such a bad habit of mine, to be chasing this elusive perfection that doesn't exist when I should be just, I don't know, I need to be more gracious with myself with things. Because I feel like if it's not perfect, I just berate myself and I'm just like overly self-critical, which isn't good for anyone. It doesn't help. It doesn't help me. It doesn't help what I'm doing. It just, yeah. I think I also need to work on spreading myself through like too thin. I feel like I take on way too much and then I end up getting it all done, but I think it like costs me something like a price. So it's, I think I need to be better about saying no to certain things. It's also probably something I should be working on. I'm really bad at saying no. Like I always like, I think internally just want to be this, like, I want to do, I've always felt like I need to be doing as much as humanly possible with what little time I have. And if I'm not doing that, then I'm just like wasting time, you know, which is awful. It's like not, it's not great. You know, it shows up in like lack of sleep and just like crazy schedule and never having downtime, you know, or never having a vacation or never getting like really a break. So yeah, I think that really comes down from like, I feel like how I was raised really informs that. Like I was really told, I think as a kid, that I should always be like hyper productive and you need to be constantly doing something. You need to be constantly working. You need to be constantly pushing. And like, yeah, I was really never taught to like take a break or slow down or, you know, or like kind of pull back. It was always like push, 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 push. And like you hit a bar, hit the next bar. Like it's this level of like pushing for this exceptionalism, which is like, I understand why it was ingrained in me, but as I get older, I see it as like way more damaging than it is beneficial. Like when I was younger, it was super beneficial because it like really pushed me. It really, really, really pushed me, but it also hindered me in a lot of ways. Like a lot of like, I mean, a good example of that was the movie I made. It was like festival ready and it was like really like it was tight. And like, I mean, these are other people's opinions. I still personally hate it and I will not watch it and it stays buried forever. But yeah, there was a movie I shot and I, you know, it was, people wanted to take it to Sundance and to Toronto and like, you know, they were like, take it fest, like shop it to festivals, like get it turned into a feature. And I was just like, I hated it. I remember the screening when I watched it. I was like, I didn't even want to show up to the screening. I wanted to blow off the screening, but then they dragged me to the screening. I physically couldn't look at it. I was like so unhappy with it. I was so, I was like internally like angry. I was like pissed because I felt like I was like, God, I'd wasted all these people's time and all this money and like, and I was like, I hate the end product and it's just not good. And like, I was just like second guessing every decision I made. And it was a miserable experience. and it came down to me being just overly critical and just seeking this like perfection. Like I don't know what I was hoping for. I think I was like, yeah, I don't know. I wanted it to be, I don't know. Like I wanted it to be like Bottle Rocket or like a, like something where, I don't know. I wanted it to hit this level of exceptionalism. That's just like kind of crazy to expect at your like first meaningful at bat. And it really did stop me from directing for a long time. I don't think I ended up directing for like a couple of years after that. It took me about I just was like, nope, fuck that. I'm just going to write. I'm just going to be a writer. I'm not going to direct. It took me like 2 years. And then I think I got the show and then I started show running, but it was one of those things that like, yeah, it was, it, yeah, for over perfectionism just isn't good. It just isn't good. It really fucks you up. So yeah, it's, those are the things I'm working on. I think I rambled way too long there. So thank you so much for the question, Nick. I really, really, really appreciate it. Let's see. Also, happy summer. It's summer in Australia right now. So happy summer. Let me see. Anonymous asks, have you ever thought about who would be your groomsmen in your wedding? Also, you're getting married tomorrow. How many groomsmen would you have? Also, have you ever been a groomsman? All right. Have I thought about my groomsmen? Yeah. I mean, I kind of have. I know who would be my best man. I mean, that goes without saying. I feel like that's abundantly obvious. I feel like even now people are writing who that is in the comments down below, so I don't even have to say it. But in terms of how many other groomsmen, probably four. Yeah, four is probably the answer. Yeah. And have I been a groom? Yeah, I've been a groom three times. I haven't been a best man yet. Although I have a couple best man opportunities maybe coming up. We'll see. We'll see. If I play my cards right, I might be a best man. If I play my cards right, I might be a best man. We'll see. We'll see how that all pans out. But yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for the question. I really, really, really appreciate it. Let's see. Nicolette asks, good morning, Kay. How do you relax before bedtime? What temperature setting do you keep it at home? And do you linger in bed or do you get right out when you wake up? Have a good week. All right, I'll start with the last one. If I linger in bed, I will just sleep in. Like, that's the danger. If I linger in bed, I'm going back to sleep. It's so dangerous for me. So I usually try to get out of bed immediately when I first wake up. That's usually the best bed for me. Because if I linger in bed, I'm just going to go back to sleep. It's just so comfy. Like, it's dangerous. And I'm also so sleepy. And I'm just like, oh, I'm going to go back to sleep. So, yeah, I have to get out. And then how do I relax before bedtime? Usually I'm writing before bed, which isn't necessarily the most relaxing thing. In fact, it's what probably keeps me up most nights. Because I'll get in like a flow and I'll be like, oh, just one more page. And then it turns into like a chapter and I'm like, fuck, one more chapter. And then it just keeps going. Because I'm like, no, I can't lose this thread. I can't lose what's happening. I need to just keep pulling it. So it's probably the worst thing I do before bed. And it's probably, I'd be better off like watching YouTube and or watching TV than writing. Cause it's one of the worst things to do before bed, but it's only time I have to write. So, yeah, it's been the bane of bedtime, for, I don't know, like the last 2 months, I think, for me. So, and then temperature settings, what do I do? Okay. So I know no one's going to be happy with this answer. The colder, the better. If it could be 30 degrees in my house, I would have it 30 degrees. I'm not even kidding. I love the cold. It is a reason to get under blankets. Like, it's just, I love the cold. So, colder, the better. But I think reasonably, I think the coldest I'll have is like 60 degrees for bedtime, if I can have it. I'll compromise and go up to 65 if I must, but yeah, like I want it to be in the 60s to go to sleep during the day. 69 is a good temperature, but you can have it hovering as high as like 74 before I'm like, oh, it's hot, you know? But yeah, in Celsius, fuck, what is that in Celsius? I think it's like what 60 is. It's like 15, right? It's like 15 degrees C. Yeah. And then like 74 is like what? 23. Yeah. So like somewhere between 15 and 24 or yeah, 24 C for those who use Celsius. I'm trying to be better about including Celsius cause I know not everyone uses Fahrenheit, which is fair cause it's not a great system. So I get it. Thank you so much for the question, Nicolette. I really, really, really appreciate it. Let's see. Bunny asks, hey, Knight, I hope you're doing well. I am doing well. My question is, do you ever feel surprised by the amount of people who are supporting you? not just for the masterpieces you make, but for who you are. Honestly, yeah, I'm always kind of shocked by it. Because I started just making audios on Reddit, and it was, I didn't think they were like super well received. I thought they were, in my personal opinion, I felt like they were okay. You know, they were fine. I never thought they were particularly great. Nor did I think I was anything to write home about, like in a meaningful way. I am quite shocked by the support. Like I'm eternally grateful for it. I'm always like beyond grateful for anyone who decides to join Patreon or listen on YouTube or comment or engage. Like all of it's just so incredibly meaningful. I think the part of it that I'm the happiest about, I think the most blessed about, is this ability to engage with people that I would have never been able to engage with otherwise, you know? Like at this moment right now, I'm talking to so many people in so many different walks of life and so many different places, and they're engaging with me back in this kind of like cosmic energetic way. And I think there's something really deeply beautiful about it. There's something about creating something that reaches people, you know, as they experience life, that I think is just kind of amazing. Because like when I make, you know, like content in a traditional sense, like, you know, like a television show or like a movie, you're experiencing it. Yeah, you're experiencing it in your life, but it's like it feels removed in a way that when you consume this, it doesn't. Like this feels like more intimately consumed than like a television show or a movie. Like this is like something that, I don't know, that you also have a part in making and creating, like not only through requests, but I think when you listen to it and engage with it as a medium, it's something that like you are putting part of yourself into it as well. And I think there's something so kind of like jointly creative about it. Like I'm giving half of this thing and then you're giving the other half of the thing, and then together we're making it whole, you know? Because otherwise it is like a one-sided kind of engagement, and like the only way that it becomes complete is the listener. Like the listener is what completes the art in a way. I feel like I got really sidetracked. I am really blown away by it. I think I'm like continuously blown away. I think we have north of 3,000 Patreons right now, which I am currently and actively thinking about a way to celebrate that. Don't think I've forgotten. I am actually actively thinking about something to do for it. It's been a wild ride, and I'm so very happy that there's been so many people who have decided to come along for the journey with me. And I mean, the journey is only really happening because of y'all. Like it's one of those things about creation and creating things. Like if there's no one, it's that idea of like, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around to hear it, does it even fall, you know? So like if I make things and there's no one out there to consume it, am I even creating anything meaningful, you know? So in a lot of ways, your existence, your participation, your engagement is giving life to a thing that without you truly would not exist. I could talk about this all day, but I am, long story short, I am surprised, and I am so, 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 so grateful for just everyone who tunes in, everyone who listens. I don't know if I could say that enough. So yeah. Thank you so much for the question, buddy. I really, 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 really appreciate it. We're over, but it's the first get to know night of the year. So it's okay. We can be over. We can be a little over, can't we? I don't think anyone minds. All right, let's see. Bianca asks, since you're a DM, have you had a total party kill or a TPK? If you have, please tell me what happened and how your party was killed. I have had a lot of total party kills. I have, I want to say north of 30, probably, yeah, at least 30 total party kills. Yeah. Because, I mean, so I have, at my peak when I was running the most amount of games, I think I was running 6 games concurrently that were weekly for about a year. And during that time, When I was in college, I was running the most amount of games because I think almost everyone around me wanted to play D&D. And I was the only one who was equipped to DM. So I was like, I was running all these games. And I had a system where I had every campaign. Well, this was when all the campaigns were still going. We're coming back to Total Party Kill. But this is when I had all the campaigns were basically in the same setting, in the same timeline. And so they were all their actions were affecting the other players, but none of the other players knew that there were other players in their world. So like in theory, they could have encountered the other players and they would sometimes run into like the remnants or the byproducts of what other players did. The reason I'm saying all this is because I think the most interesting total party kill, because there's a bunch of total party kills that were just fucking stupid. That were just like, I clearly choreographed it and was like, this thing is dangerous, don't touch it. And then the party's like, let's just like touch the thing. And then we're all like, don't touch the thing. And then they go and they touch the thing and then they all die because it does like some dumb amount of damage. Because I was like, come on, this thing has been, there's like, it's oozing a black aura. It's, you know, it's an obelisk with ancient runes on it. You get a sense of necrotic energy like emanating off of it. There's a bunch of skeletons that are touching it. They look like their skin has been peeled off once upon, like, immediately touching the obelisk. And they're like, oh, you know what I'm going to do? Guys, if we all hold hands and touch the obelisk, maybe we're strong enough to overcome it. And I'm like, please don't do that. And they all touch the obelisk and they all die. Like, that's a real total party kill. I was like, what were you guys thinking? They're like, I don't know. We thought it was a puzzle. I was like, guys, come on. But yeah, in the setting where all the players were playing in the same campaign setting, what was it? There was two of my friends. They were running separate from. They were like it was one of the subgroups, and it was just two of my friends and me. And they were running an evil campaign where they were the only people who knew that there were other players in the world. So they were like, you know what? We need to like find a way to profit off of unleashing evil. And so they unleashed like this horrific like Cthulhuan demigod from one of the planes and let him loose in a major city where they knew there were other players. And what sucked was it was a bunch of players that were very low level. They were like level 2. They were like, they were not equipped to handle what was unleashed into the city. And so when their session started and they were like, they just woke up from an inn and they heard all this noise and then they see this giant monster, they just assumed, oh, if there's a giant monster, clearly we're meant and equipped to fight it. You know, like if we see a monster, we can slay it. Like he wouldn't give us a monster we couldn't slay. And then here I'm like, oh God, please don't fight the monster. Like pick up the signs, like the city guard is running away. You know, like no one is engaging. Like every sign is like, we're evacuating, we're leaving, we need to get as far away from this place as possible. And they just were like, you know what, we're gonna be heroes. So they all like strap up and they, you know, they run headlong into danger and they just immediately got annihilated. Like they just, like I think combat lasted like 2 turns. I think only the wizard got any amount of damage in, but it was negligible. Like it was rough. And then they all looked at me like, they're like, what the fuck? Like, what is this thing doing here? And then once they wiped, I was like, okay, so here's the situation. So everyone's in the same campaign world. And so these two players knew this and they came in, they were like, they didn't know that you were in the city. They've just been going around trolling in different cities to try to create monsters. And this is the byproduct of it. I retconned them so they could not be dead. They came in contact with a god, and the god resurrected them all. And they got a bunch of stuff for it, and they showed up on one of the astral planes, and there's a whole thing, and then they were able to get back to their bodies. And so it wasn't like a traditional total party kill, but I think it was the most interesting one, because I was just like, dear God, why? Why? Anyway, this is enough D&D. I don't want to bore everyone by telling long-winded D&D stories, but yeah, that's... Thank you so much for the question, Bianca. I really, really, really appreciate it. I enjoy any chance I get to talk about D&D. Let's see. I think this will be my last question. Julia asks, hey, Kish, happy Monday. It's Tuesday, but you are right. It should be Monday, and that's my bad. I hope you're having a lovely day. I am. I hope this isn't a bit too long-winded, but I think it's interesting to think about. All right, let me see. Today, my friend was telling me that when she was younger, she wanted to date someone that didn't exist. She clarified she wanted to date someone that knew nothing of the world, like an alien or a robot, so she could show them how wonderful it is. That is incredibly sweet. She also dreamed of the ocean turning into a human that she would have, so she would have a love story with him. If you went on a date with someone that knew nothing of Earth, what would be some things you'd show them first? And if a part of nature was transformed into a human for you to fall in love with, what would it be born from? I mean, the what would it be born from is really easy for me. It'd be the ocean. I would fall in love with the ocean. I think that's probably, that's 100% my answer. Like, one, as someone who loves to sail and be on the ocean, the idea of falling in love with the ocean is like, it's kind of like every sailor's dream is to fall in love with the ocean. So, like, the ocean's obviously what I want to fall in love with. If it wasn't the ocean, the moon is definitely high up on there. But that also has, like, mad ocean vibes, falling in love with the moon. Either the moon or the ocean. Every time I think about falling in love with the moon, I'm just thinking about Sokka. Yeah, either the moon or the ocean would be my answer. What would I show the ocean first? I mean, I think if I fell in love with the ocean, I'd want to show her, like, you know, a forest, a mountain covered in snow. I would want to show her, like, basically the antithesis of what she knows, you know? I would want to show her, like, cities and just places where people congregate and show her, like, quiet nights and definitely breakfast. Breakfast would be a big one. I don't know. I think I would, you know, what would be beautiful is to take the ocean to the beach. I think would be a beautiful thing. You know, to have the ocean basically get a chance to be both on land and like, engage with herself, I think would be kind of beautiful. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's a lovely thought. It's a truly lovely thought, the idea of picking something in nature and falling in love with it. The Northern Lights is also really beautiful. That's that one really does speak with me too. Like, cause, I mean, all three of your choices obviously felt very tailor-made to me. Like, Northern Lights, the moon, the ocean, come on. All three, yeah, I would fall in love with all three of them for sure. What would be something I'd fall in love with outside of those three? Oh, a storm. A storm would be something like a, I don't know. That's that might be just my chaotic energy. But yeah, I would love to fall in love with like a hurricane or like a storm of some kind. Like just like wild, untamed energy, you know, something chaotic. And then show them the antithesis of themselves. Like, you know, show a storm serenity or something. Yeah, I don't know. It's a beautiful question and it's a lovely thought, so. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Julia. Thank you for sharing that with me. And with that, that brings us to the end of Get to Know Night. If you have a question and you'd like for me to answer it, there should be a link down below in the doobly-doo where you can ask me whatever safe word question you want. If you have a not safe word question, I highly recommend going over to Naughty Get to Know Night where you can ask me whatever naughty question you like. Anyway, I hope you have a great, great, great rest of your night. And I'll talk to you later, okay? Bye, cutie.